preparing to take on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is considered one of the toughest foreign policy issues facing the Obama administration. She plans to attend an international donors conference in Egypt on Monday to pledge some $900 million in U.S. humanitarian and reconstruction aid for Gaza. Israeli officials say that Clinton then goes to Israel for meetings with top government officials there. Palestinian officials say that she will also be making a stop in the West Bank. The pledge conference for Gaza is part of a U.S. effort to quickly influence events there and counter Hamas militant ties to Iran. Meanwhile, Israel is now working under a caretaker government after its recent elections as Benjamin Netanyahu works to form a coalition government. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming Cirque Elwaz, Nebbia. On March 3rd and 4th, they return to Champaign-Urbana with acrobatics and theatrics in the third part of the Sky Trilogy. More information is available online at KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the program, we will be talking with an environmental writer and filmmaker. Her name is Heather Rogers. She has written on the environmental effects of mass consumption for different publications, including The New York Times Magazine, The Nation, Utney, and Architecture. Her first book is all about garbage. It's titled Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, which takes a look at the history and the politics of household waste in the United States. She also has done a documentary film with the same title on the same subject, Gone Tomorrow, and that was screened in festivals around the globe. She's right now working on a book that she hopes will be published either this coming fall or maybe early next year, taking a look at the emerging green marketplace. So we'll try to talk a little bit about that. She currently is spending some time here at the University of Illinois as a guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall. And every night that she's here, she's giving a talk. And I want to mention that there will be one, a couple more that you can still take advantage of tonight and tomorrow at Allen Hall, both at 7 o'clock, talking about green cars, biofuels, and carbon offsets tonight, and then the greenhouse effect on Thursday. And anyone who is interested should feel welcome. And, of course, if you'd like to take a look at her book, you can head out to the bookstore and look for Gone Tomorrow. And questions here on the program are welcome, too. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can keep our show moving along. But, of course, anyone is interested, who is interested in joining in on the conversation should feel welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, David. Nice to be here.
I mean, very clearly, you've staked out the environment as your beat, but there are still a lot of different things you could do. I know this is not a very imaginative first question, but to take on solid waste as a major kind of project, what got you thinking about you really wanted to dig into the subject of garbage?
Well, the first thing, actually, if I could just tack on something to what you said.
Yes.
The talk on Thursday night is about green architecture. The greenhouse effect is sort of the title of the talk.
Okay.
So folks know, it's about green architecture.
Okay.
Why I started doing the research on garbage has a lot to do with, you know, there's a couple different impulses. One is, you know, just genuine curiosity. Where does my garbage go? And, you know, it's this thing that disappears. And I think a lot of people wonder, it's something that's much more, you know, being talked about much more now than it was when I first started working on this seven, eight years ago. But, you know, so it was genuine curiosity. And then once I started digging into it, no pun intended, the things that I started finding made me realize, one, that this was a pretty amazing way to find out more about how our culture and our economy and our political system work garbage, as everyone knows, when you look into the garbage can, it reveals a lot about the person, but it also reveals a lot about the society. And I also saw that it was this window through which I could view, larger environmental crisis and connect it to daily life, you know. And that's happening much more now than it was then when I first started working on this. But that's such a crucial aspect of talking and bringing the environmental discussion into popular awareness was just, how do you make these connections to daily life? Because it can seem so abstract.
Yeah. It makes me think of, this man's name escapes me, but there's an anthropologist who's really become very well known.
William Rathje.
That's the guy. For doing this and going, for example, going to landfills and looking and seeing what's there. And actually, I suppose, and no insult intended to archaeologists, but essentially what they do is they go through people's garbage, the stuff that people leave behind and they throw away, to see what they can find out about people's lives. So this guy said, well, let's do that and apply it to contemporary society and go and see what we find. And he's written a couple of books about this, and it's very interesting because, as you say, it says something about us and our society and our values and how we live if you look at what we throw away.
Not just what we throw away, but how much we throw away and how toxic it is. Maybe people have heard the statistic, but the U.S. is 5% of the global population. You know, we use about 25% of the planet's resources, including fossil fuels, and we produce about 25% of its waste. So there's a real disproportionate amount of consuming and wasting that we do. And there's a direct correlation between income and consumption and wasting.
Yeah. You in the book chart the sort of the history of waste in the United States, looking over time at how much we throw away, and then at how we deal with that, and how over time that's gone from being something that maybe a few people dealt with to being an industry on a sort of a small scale, like a small business, to big business dealing with waste. And there seem to be several points at which there have been big jumps in the amount of waste generated. Say at about 1900, big jump. Maybe about 1950, big jump. Over the last few decades, big jump. But if you go back far enough, there would have been a time when there was almost none, because people just didn't – what they had, they used up.
Yeah.
They didn't throw away a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. Where is that magic line that suddenly goes from essentially not throwing – anything away,
mm-hmm.
to when we're really starting to throw a lot of stuff away? Is there some particular point you can point
to? Yeah, there is. I mean, it really is connected to industrial production. Mm-hmm. When you start mass producing goods, you end up with, this is the thing that our society has been so good at, delivering inexpensive commodities. And as industrial production is streamlined, you have this initial in the 19th century, it's been ongoing for hundreds of years. But in the 19th century, there was a real boost to mass production. There was a concentration of people moving from the countryside to the city. So there was this pool of labor that was available. That's when there was a lot of intensification of production in factories. And also, in expansion, that's when factories started working 24 hours a day, and this kind of intensification, and child labor helped reduce the cost of production, which helped reduce the cost of commodities. So when you have all these people moving from the country to the city, there's this need that they have for buying things, because they aren't able to make them. They aren't able to repair the things that break. When you live in a place where you have more room, you can keep things and repair them. When you live in a tenement in a city, there's no space to do that. That's a logistical thing. Also, some of the other changes that were happening, at that time, that's one of the big transitions that happened in the 19th century. And then, the other kind of big push is right after World War II, where you have the streamlining of production again being driven by the innovations that were created during World War II, where industry was forced essentially by the government to cooperate with itself and with labor. And this is the full realization of what sociologists call Fordist mass production, where you have the, you know, the moving assembly line, you know, the really productive, really efficient turning out of commodities, which again drives the prices down and makes these goods that were formerly financially inaccessible to the masses now suddenly are, you know. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, there's a couple things that happen. I mean, the 1950s is a really interesting period because you have, you know, when those goods are more accessible, including, you know, large, you know, the biggest, most expensive things that people will buy in their lives, houses and cars, become more affordable with suburbanization and, again, mass production of vehicles. By the late 1950s, most people had already bought a house, a car, all the appliances they needed because of this affordability. And what happened at that point was that manufacturers started getting nervous. Japan and Germany were recovering from the war, and U.S. had been so dominant until that point, and then there was this market saturation. And there was a threat that consumption wouldn't be able to keep pace with production. And that, you know, of course, freaked out manufacturers in the U.S. And so what they did at that point was they embraced what's called built-in obsolescence, which simply put is designing things to wear out faster than they need to through fashion obsolescence or technological obsolescence or a combination of those things. And they, you know, what they came up with was we need to make more disposable. Essentially, we need to make more, you know, durable goods less durable. We need to design entirely new types of products that are meant to be disposable. And a subset of that was packaging. You know, so all of this leads to more and more wasting.
Yeah. So suddenly we have to think about what we're going to do with old refrigerators and stoves and cars and tires and clothes people bought and then decided they didn't like anymore. Yeah. And, you know, a huge range of stuff. And two, you have to also consider that there was this kind of enthusiasm for production and consumption was certainly encouraged by the government. And there was this interesting sort of turnaround from the war years when everything was about being frugal to now after the war, everything was about go out and buy and go out and spend. Mm-hmm. Because that's good for the economy. And suddenly we had this big boom. But then the question was, as you say, well, how do you sustain that if everybody's got all their stuff and got everything that they need?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the answer was to build things so that they break, you know, or so that you don't want them anymore because they don't, you know, they don't look right. There's an interesting story, you know, that was a very conscious move on the part of industry. And, mm-hmm. and there's a story about the plastic sector. Toward the end of the 1950s, there was this conference of plastic makers. And during one of the sessions, the speaker announced to his audience, who was, you know, full of plastics company executives, he said to them, "Your future is in the garbage wagon." You know, so there was this very clear understanding that if they could produce things that, you know, should go in the garbage can, they will sell more stuff.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Heather Rogers. She's journalist, writer, filmmaker, has done a lot of writing on environmental issues. She is the author of the book Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. She also made a documentary film with the same title. She is working on another book looking at the green marketplace that should be out maybe around the end of the year in the fall or the beginning of next year. She's here visiting the campus as guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall. And questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller.
Can I just jump in?
Yes.
I just want to put in a plug for – I have an article that's out in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine, the March-April issue, which is a look at biofuels and the deforestation that's happening on Borneo for expanding plantation land for oil palm to make biodiesel. So if folks are interested in that, check out Mother Jones.
Okay, great. We have a caller, a couple of callers. We'll start here with somebody in Champaign, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. You compete to be one of the first ones to call in, and then you listen to the conversation. But the issue of plastics, there certainly must have been a big – you were talking about the trend line. There certainly must have been a big spike after plastics. in this throwaway society.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other one that I find interesting is that when you walk around, you know, do your walk and all that, and you look at people with garages, you know, two-car garages, and ends up what happens is that the SUV and the other car, they're outside. If it happens to be a day that the garage is open, the garage is full of stuff, mm-hmm. you know. There was, I don't know where that conversation was, that whole industry of storage, you know, they have so much stuff that it ends up that people just keep buying more and they just keep packing it away. So I don't know if you have any comment about that or not. But.
Sure, yeah. On the plastic note, there's another great story about this that I found when I was researching it, which is when one of the first disposable plastic products was introduced. It was a rigid plastic cup that was dispensed in vending machines. And what was happening was people were drinking their coffee and then taking the plastic cup home and washing it and reusing it because it so obviously could be reused. And this kind of debate opened up in the plastics industry. And in this really wonderful magazine called Modern Plastics, if anybody's interested in spending some time in the library. And what happened was, you know, this was in the 1950s also. This debate opened up about, okay, how do we convince people who can so clearly see that this is not garbage? How do we convince them to conceptualize this as something that should go in the garbage can? You know, and so there was this very conscious effort at public education to teach people how to throw things away. This was also true in, you know, the packaging sector with the glass and can, you know, disposable glass bottles and cans. There was a great ad that I found from 1947 by the Owens Illinois Glass Company, the maker of the first disposable glass bottle. And it's really just an instruction. You know, it's an advertisement for their bottles. But it has illustrations, you know, it's this wife, this happy, you know, housewife who goes and buys beer for her husband. And instead of taking the bottles back, and there are illustrations and text explaining how to do this, instead of taking the bottle back, she puts it in the garbage can. You know, it has an illustration of her putting the bottle in the garbage can. No need to take it back to the store. And so there's a real educational component to you know, the way that we waste is not, there's nothing normal or natural or intrinsic to human, you know, nature about the way that we waste, the levels of disposability that we have. And also there's nothing normal about the levels of consumption. Like you talk about these garages full of stuff. The way that we consume and the way that we waste are learned behavior. And those are things that are constantly reinforced in our society, constant messages. I mean, everybody knows there's advertising everywhere. And, you know, that actually does affect how we think and how we relate to what we need and you know, in our daily lives. So just to say, this is learned behavior that, you know, can be unlearned, and different behavior can be learned. There's nothing inevitable about it.
Well, I am certainly of an age where I do remember returnable bottles when I was a kid, and it didn't seem like it was all that big a deal. So you would have to ask this question, or at least one question you would ask was, well, what for the bottler, I mean, for the people who are producing the product, for Coke and Pepsi and Budweiser and all those people who were switching from returnables to glass bottles that then the consumer would just throw away, what was in it for them? What was it actually to their advantage to abandon the system of bottles come back, we got to wash them out, we put the new product in there, we send them back, and we just keep doing that? What was in it for them?
That's a really good question. So, you know, the story is that it was convenience, consumer demand for convenience that drove them to make this change. It was manufacturers meeting the needs of consumers. There's a flaw in that logic that I see again and again, which is that manufacturers also have needs, and we don't talk about that. So what was happening at the time, this transition from refillable to single-use containers happened fairly gradually over the 1950s to the 1970s. So there was a real transition period. And, you know, I looked back at some of the return rates, you know, early on, and then I looked at in the 1970s when there was a rise of the mainstream environmental movement and a push for deposit laws. And in the states that initially passed deposit laws, like the state of Oregon and the state of Vermont, their return rates instantly within a year were something like 90%. You know, so people weren't not participating, even though they hadn't been participating for years. They suddenly were very interested in doing this. So if convenience doesn't explain it, you know, I went back and I looked, well, what are the other possibilities? And what I found was, you know, there were a couple, and they are economic in nature. One is that during those years, the 50s to the 70s, there's a proliferation of chain supermarket stores replacing mom and pop grocery stores. They didn't want to dedicate the storage space and labor time to managing refillable bottles. Mm-hmm. So there was that pressure from there. There was also the fact that the beverage makers, who at the time made their own packaging, they don't do that so much anymore. But they, if you bought a soda or a beer in a bottle that could be reused 20 times, they made less money. If you bought a soda or a beer in a bottle that could only be used once, and next time you had to buy another, I mean, because the consumer pays for the price of the packaging. It's embedded in the cost of the product. So if you buy a new bottle every time you buy a soda, they make a little more money. So it's a way of smuggling in more consumption. And then the third thing is that it facilitated the consolidation of the beverage industry. So if you have a refillable system, you have to have – there's a geographical limitation to the market area you have access to, because the trucks have to go back to the factory with the empties. So there's this tether. There's only so far they can go. If you get rid of the refillable system – and consolidate into large regional hubs, you have a much greater market reach, and you can expand your market share. So you look at the numbers between the 50s and the 70s, and you have, you know, really significant consolidation in the beer and soda industries. And the EPA did a study in the 1970s that said, you know, their finding was that the shift from reusable to single-use containers facilitated that consolidation. Yeah.
We're almost at our midpoint here already. And again, let me just very quickly introduce our guest, Heather Rogers. She's writer, journalist, filmmaker. She's done a lot of writing on environmental issues. Her work has appeared in The New York Times Magazine, The Nation, Utney, and Architecture. Her first book, Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, is about the history and politics of household waste in the United States. She's working on a book looking at the emerging green marketplace that will be published by Scribner either in the fall or early next year. She's right now at the moment guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall on the campus, and will be giving some talks, has already done some, and will be giving some others, talking about green cars, biofuels, and carbon offsets tonight, and a talk that's all about green architecture on Thursday. Both of these are at 7 o'clock at Allen Hall. Anybody wants to hear her can feel welcome to stop by. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Several callers here in line. First, we'll go to Belgium, the community not far from here at line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to broach a subject that you really haven't touched on yet, and which really I think started a lot of the disposable situations we have, and that's I live outside of the city limits, so therefore I have to pay for garbage pickup, and it costs between $25 and $30 a month, and it is variable upon the amount of garbage you put out. You have a basic fee, and then they charge you more if they think you're putting too much more out. And when you live inside the city limits, well, you have a guy that comes by that's contracted by either the city themselves own it, or they contract somebody that comes by and just picks up however much garbage you have, and you're taxed for the garbage pickup. Well, when you live inside town like that, well, you just throw everything out. But if you're outside of town, you try to get to a much smaller quantity because you don't want to pay more money for it. And I don't think you've brought up that topic of municipal landfills being the way they are. That's really added to this problem to a certain amount.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. The what you're saying is absolutely true. The more the easier that people have, you know, the more ready access they have to disposal sites, the cheaper it is, the more available it is, the more that they throw away.
And I'd also like to point out another little fact. For years now, I've been talking to Mr. Inge on a rotary dial phone. And I plan on keeping that rotary dial phone until it absolutely falls off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I've replaced other phones, and home and stuff that are the walk-around kind. They go bad after a very short period of time. You use them a couple, 3 or 4 years, and before you know it, they're worthless. But these tanks they built back in about 1950, they just don't quit. And it's also forcing the phone company to keep an old technology, which is the rotary dial, which seems to me a good idea.
Right. I mean, that gets back to the built-in obsolescence question.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, there are some places, for example, here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, the cities do not do trash hauling. Every household has to contract with a hauler for the service. I think that there are some, and I know that in other places what they have tried to do as a way to cut down on the amount of solid waste that's generated is institute some kind of volume-based pricing that says, okay, you put out this much, here's what it'll cost. But if you find some way to put out less, we'll charge you less. Has that helped in reducing the amount of solid waste that people produce?
I don't know the statistics on whether that's been efficacious or not. I mean, I imagine to some extent it has been. One of my issues or questions with that is that, you know, when you go to the grocery store, you don't really have that big of a choice. If you want to buy something, often, you know, you don't have the option of buying it without packaging. And, you know, those are the kinds of changes that I think would be more effective. It is effective to ask people to pay more, you know, to pay. Essentially, it's called pay as you throw. That's not ineffective, but I think it avoids some of the more important questions that need to be asked, which is what are the decisions that producers are making and how can we affect those so that we have less waste to begin with?
Yeah. And I think that that's certainly one of the points you make in the book is that people who make products and then who put them in packages and then that's the way we buy them. I think over time, what they have tried to do is spin the trash problem as a consumer problem. They say to people, be responsible, dispose of this responsibly, be a good citizen, as if it was all pretty much our problem. It's all on the individual and not on any kind of decisions they'd make about their products and how they package them and how they sell them.
Right, and again, this is the dynamic of avoiding the obvious, you know, that manufacturers have needs, you know, and putting it all on, well, we're just meeting consumer demand. You know, we're doing, you know, there's this idea that the market is something that is somehow flawless in creating efficiencies and somehow protecting the environment, which it can't do, obviously, we wouldn't have global warming. The market has limits and I was interviewing an economist yesterday and he said this to me, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, over the last several years, we've developed a fascination with the market and we've endowed it with qualities and abilities that it simply doesn't have. And, what you're talking about is, there's a way that, if we can start just sort of, you know, seeing it, it's really crucial that we see this not simply as, the outcome of individual choices. And you know, what's happening now, I mean, I can talk about historical stuff. In the 1950s, the beverage container industry and beverage makers got together and formed an organization that many people will have heard of called Keep America Beautiful, which presented itself as a civic organization, beautification organization. And really, it was a corporate greenwashing front group. In response to the first law in the United States, which was passed in Vermont, to restrict the sale of throwaway glass bottles. They didn't want this to happen because of the reasons I explained before. It would eat into their profitability. And, and a big accomplishment of Keep America Beautiful was turning the focus off of industry, off of the extraction of materials from the ongoing intensifying extraction of materials from nature and the ongoing intensifying dumping of wasting into nature, to turn it away from that and focus on the individual. And they've been very effective. We've really internalized that message. You know, every time I do a public event, people always say, you know, but what can I do? You know, what can I do? And it's important. We do need to take action, absolutely. But I think that that action needs to be connected to a more fundamental approach to how the system works, and not just what can I buy, or, you know, what can I drive, or, you know, those types of questions.
Yeah. Let's take some other callers. Let's go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that manufacturers need to be maybe even taxed to pay for the eventual disposal of the things that they produce. But this whole issue has come up recently in three ways locally. Local landlords have had complaints against them because of their overflowing dumpsters, particularly when students move out. The landlords in Champaign versus in Urbana have been successful at preventing apartment recycling, whereas in Urbana we have a hauler that picks up recycling at apartments as well as in individual homes, and that's paid for by a separate municipal tax. That's different from what we pay individually for haulers to come and get the garbage. I mentioned before that in our own home, we have so little garbage because we recycle, we compost, we use freecycle.org and Craigslist and Habitat and local organizations to get things to people who can reuse them. The third thing is that the local newspaper was touting that, oh, we have 18 years left on our local area landfill that we have to truck our stuff. I don't know how many miles it was. Not in Champaign-Urbana anymore.
It's in Danville.
And I thought to myself, you know, if Champaign had been recycling the way Urbana has been, we would have many more years left. The landlords wouldn't have complaints and a proposed ordinance for fencing in their dumpsters because more stuff would get recycled. In Urbana, our recycling tax paid for not just the little open containers that you have to lift and haul to the curb, but to big garbage can size rolling toters that are covered. We can get all of our cardboard, cans, glass, newspapers, the junk mail that comes, all that stuff in the containers. And I think the article at the time said that recycling in Urbana went up by something like 30% when those were made available to residents. You don't have to use them if it doesn't work for you. But I'm thinking to myself, you know, here's Champaign is with all these students, all these apartments, and dumping all this stuff to landfills. And it seems to me it has to be a multi-pronged approach. One, reducing what comes in, making the manufacturers pay for and the consumers pay for the amount of packaging, and make things more recyclable, as well as make it easier for people to recycle. A lot of people don't know, especially in Champaign, about how to recycle, mm-hmm. what's recyclable, et cetera, because they're not paying for a municipal service that reminds them, so that when new people come into the community, they don't know.
Right, right. Again, in some ways, that links back to the idea of learned behavior. Something that I was thinking when you were talking is that, you know, you're describing your practices. The separating of waste is something that is much more normal to human activity and our way of living in modern society. And one thing that we've come, one of the stories our culture has come to tell itself is that we just normally throw things away mixed together. That's just how, you know, humans are made up, is we do that. And separating waste is really complicated, and we don't like to do it, and we're lazy, or, you know, something like that. When actually throwing wastes away mixed together is the historical anomaly. Sorting our discards is the norm. And there's only a brief period of time. We don't think about it like this. We think like, you know, there's only a brief period of time in which we threw our wastes away all mixed together, and that's from right after World War II up through the late 1960s. You're talking a few decades there. And, you know, what we the way that we often think about it is like, you know, well, we don't, you know, there was the Depression and World War II when everybody was, there was a sort of enforced austerity. And then we started recycling in the you know, essentially a little bit in the 1970s, but more in the late 1980s, early 1990s. That was when we finally understood we needed to do something. But you know, that's an inaccurate narrative. Because there was just extensive sorting and recycling that happened, you know, well up through the post-war era. And a lot of, you know, listeners who've been around for more years will remember that.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller for her for raising those points. Real quick, one thing I want to bring up, and I think it's something that you deal with in the book, is that I guess a really significant amount of the stuff that generally is thrown out is organic material. It's stuff that could be composted. And, you know, maybe there aren't a lot of people that can actually do that for themselves. But if we could do that, and obviously there would have to be a system instituted for that if people were going to then put compostable material out and someone was going to come and get that, you'd have to have an infrastructure to deal with that. But how helpful would that be if we could then separate that kind of stuff out, in addition to having people separate out their cardboard and aluminum cans and glass, food waste, stuff like that, that could be composted? How would that help? Would that help?
Yeah, a huge amount of what goes into landfills. 85% of what we discard goes to landfills. 15% goes to incinerators. So by far, you know, most things go to the landfill. And some huge proportion of that is compostable. I can't remember the number off the top of my head.
I thought that it was something like 60%.
That's what I think it is too.
Yeah. Which is an astounding amount when you
absolutely
think about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you could divert, you know, that much just by composting. And there are all these questions about, well, you know, there's more cost involved. You have to make an extra truck trip. What are the environmental implications of that? And I think a lot of those are, you know, end up being kind of false arguments because, you know, I'm no economist and I don't know how to do that kind of, you know, those kinds of calculations. But there's certainly efficiencies achieved when you're doing, when you're not throwing things away and you're making something that can be reused, you know, in a beneficial way. Mm. So there are programs like this that exist. There's a good one in San Francisco. People pay a lot more for their service, but they have curbside compost pickup, and it seems to be very effective.
But 12 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Heather Rogers. She is an environmental writer, journalist, filmmaker. The book that she's written on this subject, if you want to look at it, is titled Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, published by New Press. She's also made a documentary with that same title. She's here visiting the campus. She's currently a guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall. And questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Next up, I believe we'll talk with someone in Urbana and line 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. This is such a fascinating and important topic. It could just go on, and I wish it could. But I have a couple of, well, several thoughts. One regarding the transit of compostable materials. I live on a street that's only two blocks long, and there are at least four garbage trucks that come by every Tuesday. Something could be done about that. Another thing I've been thinking about for so many years is, isn't there a way we could figure out to tax plastic or the materials that go into it, which would make it less exciting, less profitable, less hopefully less use of plastic, plus maybe pay for some of the damage it does. And a third issue, advertising. Advertising, I think, does so much harm to our environment. And pretty much, this is oversimplification, but advertising is considered a business expense and can be deducted from taxes. So It's either cheap or free to advertise. So a lot of this, I think, could be addressed with different kinds of policy. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, you can respond to any of that. The point about all the garbage trucks, that's a consequence of the fact that everybody contracts as an individual household with a hauler. So we have all these haulers all crisscrossing all over the place. Some of them say, we serve just a particular area. But that could be true on a given street. Every house could have, or every couple of houses could have somebody different. So on the day that they come, one guy comes and takes away a few, and another guy comes and takes away a few more, and somebody else comes and takes away a few more. I think some people would say, that really doesn't make sense, but that's the way we do it here.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that is the result of the, ironically enough, greater environmental controls have facilitated that type of thing happening, where in the 1970s, in the mid-1970s, a law was passed that said landfill sites have to meet certain minimum safety requirements. And it was implemented in the mid to late 1980s. And at that time, 70 to 90% of landfill sites did not meet these minimum standards and so were shut down. And a lot of people remember the garbage crisis that happened in the late 1980s when there was the garbage barge floating up and down the East Coast that couldn't find a place to dump its waste. And what happened at that point was, you know, then in the early 1990s, further environmental protections were enacted that required landfill sites to use the current system, which is like, you know, these thick liners and drainage systems and vents for methane, all of which are good, but they create tremendous costs that municipalities can't afford. And so what that's done is it's forced a consolidation of the waste industry, and it's driven municipalities out of handling waste. And so you have this privatization of waste handling that has ensued, which leads to these kinds of problems. On the point of plastics and taxing producers and possibly even consumers, it's very hard. Somebody mentioned this earlier too. You know, taxing producers for the packaging that they make and things like that. It's hard to do that because the producers will just pass those costs on to the consumer. You know, that used to be something that was questioned, but now it's not anymore. Producers can do that pretty much without hesitation. And, will that work? I don't know. You know, I don't know if that is actually effective at encouraging them to produce less waste. They benefit, from having consistent, reliable, clean, which means virgin, you know, feedstocks from nature. And, you know, it's just easier to work with. You get the clear, clean-looking plastic when you have brand new inputs. If you try to use recycled plastic, you get cloudy, you know, uneven. You can't get the bright, you know, colors for your laundry liquid and things like that for the bottles. So manufacturers don't like using recycled materials often. Sometimes they do, but often they don't. And so it suits their needs better. The plastics industry has fought very hard against any kind of controls. In the late 1980s, during this garbage crisis, some states were considering putting restrictions on plastic packaging. If we can just, you know, reduce that, then we'll have less garbage to throw away. And the American Plastics Council, which is the powerful lobbying group of the plastics industry, intervened and they said, well, wait, you know, we'll do a self-regulation, a voluntary regulation. We'll put this recycling code numbers on all the plastics, and that will encourage people to recycle, and then you'll have less waste. And, you know, so everybody knows these, it's the triangular chasing arrow symbol with a number stamped in the middle. Mm-hmm. And what has turned out is that this numbering system is incredibly unhelpful for plastic recycling, because those numbers vaguely indicate different types of plastics, but in ways that aren't particularly helpful for recycling. You can have number one and number two that can't be, you know, number two there's different types of number two plastic. There's different types of number one plastic, and they can't be mixed together. If they do, there's a contamination that happens and you can't use it. And those kinds of distinctions are not made in this coding system. The other thing about the coding system, so it's created, you know, a huge, I mean, basically a lot of plastics recyclers end up with warehouses full of wasted plastic that they can't do anything with and they just have to send to the landfill. And the other aspect of this labeling system is that that recycling symbol, that chasing arrow symbol, which is on a lot of other products as well, is in the public domain. It's not something that is in any way regulated. So it doesn't mean that a product can be recycled, will be recycled, or was made from recycled material. So, you know, you have these industries, you know, and the plastics industry is connected to the oil sector. You know, it's connected to the fossil fuel sector, which is the most powerful industry in modern history. And they have, you know, incredible political clout. And, you know, it's something that if we want to take on, we have to take on in a systemic way.
A couple of other callers here. We'll try to get as many as we can in the time that's left. Let's go next to somebody on the cell phone. This is line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How much do we consume compared to the world?
It depends on what you're talking about, but my numbers are, I don't have them fresh in my head, but roughly, you know, twice as much as Europe, sometimes a third as much, you know, 30% more, but sometimes twice as much, a lot more.
I really don't have a problem with everybody consuming what they do, and I really appreciate people that recycle, but everybody who earns deserves what they get. And you said you wrote a book, and you have a website, and you did a film?
Yeah.
It's a perfect opportunity to start something on your website to have a bunch of people donate, and you could start running a business, and then boom, it'd take off sooner or later, and then you'd be able to compete with them. I don't know how you'd start that, but I'm sure there's a lot of people that want to move in your direction, and, I mean, you can do what they did and overcome them, because I imagine that if this global warming is true, I mean, people are going to rather go to your company than their company. Even though they're going to have the advantage right now, sooner or later, everybody's going to start to, you know, see what they're doing. And that waste builds up. And I think technology is being held back that we don't know about that could, you know, transfer that into energy, because everything's energy. I just... You know,
well, I appreciate you the caller's comments, because I think that what that does is, you know, it does raise this question. Well, is there possibly some, you know, you're not going to start a waste disposal company. Your job is a journalist. You write about the issues. Somebody else is going to have to start the company. But that leaves open the question of, well, could there be some kind of really novel approach to dealing with the problem that we're not now doing, you know, and this we won't be able to talk about the project that you're working on now. We'll just have to wait till the book comes out and then we can talk again.
Come back.
But that gets to this area of, well, you know, we're now talking about green industry, that we can both have economic development and deal with our environmental issues at the same time. So is there some kind of novel solution to this problem that we've talked about that does both of those things, that's, you know, that generates economic activity and at the same time help you know, deals with this very significant problem that we have?
Mm-hmm. There's a transition period that's going to happen, which is, you know, partly getting funded by the stimulus package that the Congress just passed. And that is, you know, weatherization of homes, investment in renewable energy. There's going to be growth around that. There's going to be growth around buying, you know, installing more windmills, solar panels, you know, whatever systems we use. In addition to that, geothermal, tidal, you know. So there's going to be growth in those areas as that is happening. I think it's really important for us to question, you know, can an economy that's based on growth and expansion be, is it able to prioritize environmental health? I mean, that is really a question that is important to ask, and is not getting asked. And I think that, you know, I think that if you have an economy that is based on growth, how does that growth happen? It happens by extracting ever more resources from nature. Now, whether that is, ore to make steel for windmills, or, silicon to make, photovoltaic cells, you're still extracting resources from nature. And we need to deal with that. We need to talk about it. We need to think about it. There are a lot of people doing research, a lot of scientists, engineers, urban planners, architects doing incredible amounts of research, and they have tremendous ideas of solutions. I really believe in all the research that I've done and the people I've talked to. There's no shortage of solutions whatsoever. The problem is how to implement them and how to get them out of the margins and into the center, and how to get the powerful interests of, say, the oil sector, how to get those how to quiet those down a little so that we can start hearing these other voices that are there and that have real solutions. And we also need to really think, what kind of society do we want to have? And can we define growth differently? There isn't just one definition for a healthy economy. And we need to feel empowered to ask those questions.
We'll try to get at least one more caller. Let's go to Chicago. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
A simple solution to some of the problems: make all beer and beverage cans out of steel, and the magnet will pick all those out instantly, and it goes right back to the mills instead of the aluminum and plastic and glass. The steel cans, it'll go back to the mills in 2 minutes and can be melted down and put back into circulation.
Well, what do you think?
Well, one of the interesting things about metal is that it's very recyclable, and it's something that really can be used over and over again. Aluminum as well as steel, and glass and plastic and paper all break down over time. It's called downcycling, and you can't infinitely recycle those things. The paper fibers get shorter. The glass gets it starts to kind of be reprocessed a few times. And when it has to be mixed with virgin plastic to be useful. So you can't turn a water bottle back into another water bottle. That's impossible to do.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to end because we're here come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks to the callers. Also, if you would like to read more on this particular subject, you can look for the book that Heather Rogers, our guest, has written. The title is Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, published by the New Press. She's also done a documentary with the same title. She has an article in the current issue of Mother Jones. It's about biofuels. So you can take a look at that. She's here visiting. She's guest in residence at Unit 1. That's in Allen Hall. She's given a number of talks. She'll be giving two more, one tonight, one tomorrow at 7, talking about green cars, biofuels, and carbon offsets tonight, and then about green architecture tomorrow. And coming up sometime soon, maybe in the fall, maybe beginning of next year, another book about the green marketplace. We can talk about that when the book comes out.
Sounds good.
All right. And she makes her home in New York.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah, so it's nice to be here.
Thanks very much.
Thank
for
you.
Giving us your time.
Thanks,
we appreciate
Dave.
It. Coming up in the next hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a journalist who's written an interesting book that is titled The Survivors Club, which looks at this question of why it is that some people make it through the most difficult trials and others don't. His name is Ben Sherwood, so we'll have more on that in the next part of Focus 580. Before that, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, for an update on the markets and for news, so please stay tuned.
And good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. We're seeing that corn is showing some strength, while we see that the soybeans are a little bit on the downside. They're a little bit under fire here at the mid-session. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars, and as we do that, we see that in Kansas City, March wheat is at 556¾, up 5½. At the Chicago Board of Trade, March wheat is at 519¼, up 4. The May contract of 530 and now 529 and three quarters, up 3.5. July, 542 and three quarters, up 4.5. March corn, 356, up 1.75. July, 374 and a quarter, up 1.75. The December at 396 and a quarter, and it is up 2 on the day. April crude oil at $40 is up 4 cents. The March RBOB at 115 and 9 tenths is up 7 and 5 tenths. March beans, 871 and 3 quarters, down 9 and a quarter. July.